This is the La Carre Cast. Hello and welcome to the La Carre Cast. My name is Jeff and I'm your host. Each episode, we take a deeper dive in all things La Carre. Today, I'm pleased to welcome back to the show Matthew Bradford. Matthew previously spoke with me about A Murder of Quality, and today is here as we do a close reading of A Private Spy. We're going to be breaking this up into three separate episodes, each looking at a different aspect revealed in the book. The personal, the professional, and what was revealed about his novels. This week, we're going to be discussing some of the personal relationships that we get a closer look at. Matthew, thanks for coming on to talk even more La Carre.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
All right. So before we get too far in the weeds, what was your general opinion of this book?
I loved it. I mean, I'm a broken record on these things, but we talked about Silverview being a gift. This is another great gift of like things that fans have gotten since he passed away. I mean, we were so devastated, and obviously, you know, it felt like the end of things, but they've kept things coming. And this one, it's one of the best letters books that I've read. I went back and forth between reading it and listening to the audiobook, and both experiences were fantastic. I loved, you know, reading it, especially the things where he's illustrated letters and stuff was really great to actually see his drawings. And then listening to it, it's David Harewood reading the letters themselves and Florence Pugh reading the explanatory notes. And they both do just a wonderful job. And she, like, for some of those illustrated letters, for example, like he'll be reading the letter. And then when it describes, you know, what the picture is, he'll be like, read the line, and she'll say race car or something, but it really works. And it was a pleasure to listen to that way, as well as a pleasure to read. Normally when I get letters books, I like to jump around in them more than read them straight through. But this one, I really enjoyed reading straight through. It was all credit to his son, Tim Cornwell, tragically passed away right before it was published, but did an amazing job putting these together. It was really, it read like another autobiography, but it didn't feel redundant on the Pigeon Tunnel. It just, the way that the letters were assembled, you really got a sense of his life. You know, I don't know that I'd say it would replace the Pigeon Tunnel, but it's certainly a great supplement to it. And I don't think you would need to have read. I know you talked about this with Steve that, you know, whether it stands on its own, I think it does stand on its own. If you weren't familiar with him at all, I don't see why you would be reading it. But you know, if you're a fan of his books but haven't read any biographies or autobiographies, I think you can go straight to the letters and get a real sense of the man that doesn't even come across in the Pigeon Tunnel, where he is very guarded. Because this, I this is the most unguarded that I feel I've ever read Le Carre. You know, maybe once in a while in some previously published letters, but in a whole book of them, it definitely seems like his guard is down more than it was in the Pigeon Tunnel, where he was really putting up a lot of walls while telling those stories of his life.
Yeah, I agree. Although I'd say, you know, the unguardedness you got more so early on than later. You know, the further into the book you get, the more kind of you can feel him pulling up the drawbridge over the moat there. The later on, because I do think you get the sense that he's more aware of his position in the world and people's view of him the older he got. Do you agree? Or
yeah, I think that's true. But I also think, though, that, I mean, he even says in one of the letters that he's, you know, he's thinking about everything that he writes now as a letter is for posterity and for his archive. He's kind of joking, but he's also clearly serious. But at the same time, I would say that Tim really managed to find some good letters where he's, you know, because of the person he's writing to, he's not being particularly guarded. And on top of that, I just think that he's not guarded about his personality in his letters. And he was in the Pigeon Tunnel. Like in the Pigeon Tunnel, I don't think the sense of humor came through that comes through in these letters, really. You know, I mean, there were some funny anecdotes in the Pigeon Tunnel, but I don't know. It feels in that as in his most of his novels that, you know, he takes himself very seriously. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, he is a serious writer who deserves to be taken seriously. But in the letters, I feel that you get a lot more self-deprecation and just kind of like just joking than you do in the Pigeon Tunnel. And that seems unguarded to me.
Yeah. Let's start diving into some of these letters, and particularly the kind of the personal aspect of these. And we start off right off the bat with a letter of 13-year-old David Cornwell to the headmaster of the school he was going to. And is there any more English kind of start to you know, the impression that we get of somebody than that? I kind of love that as an intro, right?
Yeah, it definitely feels very English to me. But again, we're talking about a very particular class of English. We shouldn't say that we're making broad generalizations of the whole country. But yeah, for his class and his time, it definitely feels like quintessential.
Yeah, well, it's like a very Harry Potter introduction there, right? Almost, doesn't it feel? You know, like he's getting the owl sent to him, the letter to go to Hogwarts, right?
Right. And combined with that, we also get, I mean, later on, the explanatory notes don't so much provide the texts of other letters, but there we do get, I think, a full letter from his stepmother to the headmaster too, just sort of like talking about how she spoils him, but she can't wait for him to get some discipline, you know, at school and stuff. And that was interesting, especially setting the seeds of the relationship that he has with her. We also get the information early on that she was the one who had first read to him, because Ronnie didn't believe in books, really. You know, he believed in being self-made and not having an education, and that she read The Wind in the Willows to him when he was a kid. And that comes up several times throughout this collection of letters, that formative reading of The Wind in the Willows. And it was interesting to establish it first at the beginning, since it does get returned to. I mean, that's a great way to begin a book of letters by a writer too, with basically his introduction to words. And beyond that, she was also the one who took him to see his first play, to see it was Shakespeare, but I forget which one it was. Do you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it also plays into the fact that, you know, this letter is the introduction for a lot of his angst, right? Because he does, you know, he leaves, you know, these boarding schools. He's not comfortable there, but then he gets kind of dragged back in to be a teacher, you know, in these elite institutions. And so he's kind of like fighting against these class things that it sets it all right up from the very start.
Yeah. Although I was a little disappointed that there weren't more letters from his time as a teacher. That actually was pretty glossed over, maybe because they don't exist, maybe because they weren't very interesting, but that period of his life isn't very covered in letters. But yes, it certainly does establish from the start. You know, later on, he had one that, again, one that you and Steve discussed about to Vivian Green, talking about how his life looked very good from the outside, but it was a largely miserable life. And honestly, it doesn't sound like it to me, but I know a lot of his misery came from that school experience, and also, of course, from the home life that sent him to there, you know. But it's something that we see in his books, from Murder of Quality to Perfect Spy and other things, that English public school system, he really hated that. And that was clearly a beginning of, you know, so yeah, another good place to begin. And then fairly quickly in this book, because obviously Tim Cornwell doesn't want to dwell too long on his childhood, so fairly quickly we get to him being out of school and basically escaping it, you know, which is something he talked about in the Pigeon Tunnel too. But it's interesting getting these letters where there's a real sense of that. I mean, he says he just had to get out of England. I think that's a letter to his future wife. It's interesting that England is a prison to him right from the beginning.
Well, in one of his letters to Anne, it's interesting, you know, he talks about England, you say, as being a prison, but then he's also already kind of railing against America back in 1945 when he was writing a letter, because he went to visit his brother Tony, who was there, and he's already kind of giving the U.S. The business there, because a theme that we'd see him return to again and again in his later novels, right?
Later novels and later letters.
So if nothing else, I guess, you know, we can say that he wasn't hypocritical in his disdain for the United States. It was deeply, deeply felt from way back when.
Yeah, although I think we should make it clear that, because he gets obviously a lot of flack in critics from critics for that sometimes too, well, from certain class of critics anyway. And in his famous essay, "The United States of America Has Lost Its Mind," about the Iraq War, like, and even in this very first letter about Tony becoming Americanized, I never get the feeling that he doesn't like the American people, you know. And he had great friendships with his American editors. Unfortunately, his first one is one that they point out the letters are lost. I think Tim Cornwell says that in his introduction, that all the correspondence between Le Carre and his original American editor was returned to him and he burned it. So that's really too bad, because Seisman talks about the close friendship that they had until they didn't. And then later on, Bob Gottlieb was clearly such a huge influence on him. From the Book of Letters, I don't get the sense that any of his UK editors ever had the influence or impact on him that Gottlieb did. So, you know, I think he always had American friends and liked American people. It's more the politics of the country that he was against. I don't see him as an anti-American.
Which is weird as far as the editor's relationship, right? I mean, that's a curiosity to me, given the fact that, you know, Gottlieb and I'm blanking on his other earlier American editor's name, Jack Gahagan. Who was his first editor as well. Like, we've gotten so much of those relationships, and I don't know that I could even, I'm not quite sure who his editors in Britain were. I mean, obviously, yeah, I mean, Victor Gollancz, right? I mean, early on,
yeah.
But beyond that, I'm not sure we don't get a lot of that. You know, the one we hear about is his agent, you know, Johnny Geller. We know about their relationship,
right,
which was really strong. But as far as a UK editor, I'm not sure of. Although there is that great, we'll get to it in a later episode, his letter on the care and feeding of John Le Carre, right?
Yes. when I think when Penguin was becoming his publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
You know, one of the other letters that we get is a letter to Caspar von Almen, his friend from Bern. And it really, I thought that was a really striking letter that he had. It really broke down his guilt over what his father did and kind of his implied complicity in that, right? For going along, for taking this money, for being able to go to these schools using this kind of dirty money. And, you know, obviously that his relationship with his father and that guilt is a topic we see him return to again and again. But this really got quite to the heart of it in a way that I don't recall seeing elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And that letter struck me too, because, I mean, that letter is what we now would call being aware of his privilege. I mean, he very much is, and it's not an earned privilege. It's a stolen privilege. So he feels very guilty about it, that there are people out there who have lost everything to his dad, and that's the money that's putting him through school and stuff. And there will be subsequent letters, you know, where he refuses to let his father pay for things, but there will also be subsequent letters where he is accepting that money. So that's an interesting thing, because in this one, yes, he's very guilt-ridden about it. What? And he remains angsty and guilt-ridden about it in both his letters and in his work. But he also, he does keep, you know, it's not until he really becomes fully self-dependent when he's a successful writer that he is actually able to break ties with his father. Like, he has these economic connections to him. He's dependent on him. So even when he's in Switzerland and he sees himself as escaped from England, escaped from the school, escaped from his family life, he hasn't really, because he's still dependent on the money that Ronnie's sending, even if he's already said, I don't want to live on a penny of. We then get other letters that indicate that he is living on that money. And what else would he be living on? I mean, he's not working, he's a student. So it makes sense that he would take that money again when he had to, but it's interesting coming after that letter, because he feels so torn about it there. He knows that his privilege is paid for by other people's ruin.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I think it is striking how he was not very well off, you know, as far as, you know, I mean, it's all relative, right? But, like, when he was younger, before he hit it big with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, he was kind of skating by to a great extent, right? You know, I mean, the fact that he could stay in these the housing provided by these schools, and then finally getting these positions in MI5 and later MI6. I mean, it was more of almost necessity versus any sort of like, you think of the tap on the shoulder is with the people who are already have that privilege, who can afford to go to work for the state, versus somebody that is really kind of needs that connection to a stable job.
Definitely. But even when he's still at Oxford, working there, and when he's married, he's still partly living subsidized by his father. And there are letters that just refer to that, that don't go into the guilt that he goes into in that early letter. So it's interesting because, you know, he had to still be feeling that guilt as long as he was. But he talks about how he couldn't afford to live in Oxford if he weren't being subsidized by his father to some degree. And it's very interesting in that one letter that's in there to his dad, because, again, that's one that many of them were destroyed by him. It's almost more financial than personal. It's like this idea that I don't want your money, but I'll take it, is kind of like, because I need it.
Yeah.
And I can understand that. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're still in that kind of world where I could not have gotten by in LA without my parents helping me, you know, like it's still a world where that's pretty necessary. But the fact that the subsidies are coming from money that he knows is ill-gotten is interesting, because we get that early letter about it, and I'm sure it's still tearing at him. And we get other letters, particularly to Vivian Green, who knows all about his family situation, that talk about that guilt. But then we also get letters that just sort of offhandedly refer to money that he's getting from his father. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Vivian Green, there's a nice letter in there where he's kind of crowing about the release of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the book, and the sale of the film rights to that. And, you know, he also refers to, because of the film, as a Woodhouse, P.G. Woodhouse and Mr. Mulliner fan. I love his reference to the author and the fictional film studio that he had created in those books. And so, you know, I know it's been much said that he was a big fan of Worcester and Jeeves and all of those novels. And so getting that kind of referred to there was a fun thing as somebody who also enjoys those books.
Me too. I love that as a running thing throughout all the letters. Like, he'll just drop these casual references to Woodhouse throughout, you know, because clearly his family was all into them too. You know, his sons must have read them all, because he'll give them these references. And, you know, he'll just tell people, you know, reference the cow creamer or something that, like, it's this shared language of, like, he knows all these people know, they speak Woodhouse, you know, to the degree that you and I speak Le Carre, you know, like, and could write letters. Were we ever compelled to write a handwritten letter, you know, it's a lost art, as you say, but, you know, we could talk about lamplighters and stuff and know what we meant. And he talks about cow creamers, or about, I think he mentions Gussie and his newts and one thing, you know, it's just these like little offhand mentions of the world of Jeeves and Wooster and other Woodhouse characters throughout the letters. And it's really great, you know, as a big fan of something, you know, like, we're both definitely huge fans of John le Carré, and then to read him and realize that, you know, he's also a huge fan of something, and it, so much so that it works its way into his letters and presumably into his speaking as well. You know, I have to assume that this writing to some degree reflects how he talked to his sons and his family members and stuff. And I bet his conversation was also peppered with Jeeves and Wooster references. I got a big kick out of that too.
Yeah, that was fun. The other thing that was a bit of a revelation for me, and I talked about it a bit with Stephen Ritterman, but just, you know, his letters to his stepmother, and in particular, one that was really striking was when he talks about running into his father in New York City, and, you know, just about how he was, you know, his father's bumming money everywhere, bouncing checks, and then he happens to be eating in the same restaurant that his dad shows up in, which, you've got to think, looking back on how much of a coincidence that might have really been, knowing his father, right? And just that whole situation, right?
Yeah. I think Sisman actually told us that that was an engineered event by Ronnie, I believe. Yeah. So it was interesting then seeing the other side of this letter where he really does seem to think it was a coincidence when he's writing to her. But I could be wrong. But my recollection is that Sisman actually did figure out that that particular event had been engineered by Ronnie. And, you know, I'm sure that any time that he, by coincidence, ran into Ronnie, it had been carefully orchestrated. Funny that the trained spy wouldn't pick up on that. But yeah, it seemed from this letter like he really did think it had been a coincidence. And yeah, those letters to his stepmother, they're really great. But what they give me most is a new insight into Jerry Westerby's relationship with his stepmother in The Honorable Schoolboy, where it's honestly these kind of weird scenes in the book where he calls her Pet. That's his name for her. And they'll go, you know, talking about the teacups or whatever things that Westerby's father has squandered, who, you know, one of the many father characters throughout his books who bears, you know, a lot of DNA from Ronnie. Westerby's father was a lord who owned horses, owned newspapers, and squandered everything, sort of. And so his stepmother is really living on just the detritus of this former glory. And it's really now feels almost like those letters put into prose. Like all the scenes between Westerby and his stepmother just really feel like these letters from Le Carre to his stepmother.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things that we dive into are some of the letters exploring the kind of weird relationship between James Kettaway and Le Carre. In particular, there was one where he's just gushing about Kettaway's novel. And, you know, there's that line where he's like, two scenes I really dig. You know, I mean, because this is the late 60s, and even Le Carre would be, you know, leaning into some of that terminology. And I love how Tim Cornwell has that great little footnote talking about how The Bells of Shoreditch, which is the novel that he's referring to, is now, you know, after he's been saying, you know, this will last forever. Everyone will be talking about this book for ages and ages. Tim Cornwell says, you know, the Bells of Shoreditch is only available secondhand and is quite inexpensive to find. So that was a great little footnote in there that I love.
Yeah, but also he juxtaposes that letter with one then to Kenaway's wife right after it, where he's just effluviant in his wooing of her, you know. Yeah. Like he's really, it's the most probably over the top love letter in the book. And there's a couple. We know that he burned a lot of his love letters to his various mistresses and to his wives as well. Yeah, that one you get right after that Kenaway letter, where he's really like praising Kenaway, almost like, I don't know if it's hero worship. I mean, it does smack somewhat of hero worship, but then also of sort of sucking up to him. And then he's writing to his wife about how much he loves her and how their love is real, unlike the love that Le Carre has with his first wife. And actually, that letter struck me as very immature compared to some of the others. Like, even that very first one that you start with is a very mature letter for a schoolboy about to embark on his career at school. But in other things, you know, and I'm sure, you know, Freudian analysis would have all sorts of fun with, you know, how not having a mother in his life affected Le Carre's relationships with women, which he talks about throughout in various letters. But he seems pretty backwards in that. And then also, again, as he points out, just the way that the all boys school, you know, also sets him up to really just not knowing women. And yeah, his letters to Anne sometimes seem kind of childish, his early letters when he is in love with her. And then this letter to Susan Kenaway, where it's like, yeah, a full-on love letter, but feels very almost like something that you'd expect written by a high schooler rather than a successful writer in his late 20s, early 30s, you know?
Yeah.
Did you feel that way, or is that just my take?
No, I mean, I'd say all of the love letters, mainly probably the last love letter I wrote was probably like in my teens, you know? I mean, it's probably hard to write a good love letter. In general, I think the fact that they just felt very odd to me in a way, like very needy in a way that I don't know if he would have recognized, but it felt to me like he was trying a little too hard, and maybe that came out more so because it's in a letter than not. I don't know if that's making any sense.
No, it does. Yeah, I think he is neat. There's definitely a neediness in his letters to women he's involved with. And it is interesting. I mean, I'm kind of jumping ahead now. You probably have the letter where he talks about therapy that he might have done, but didn't, marked for later in this discussion of the personal. But it is interesting that he was going to see a therapist in London, and then for weather or whatever reason, he wasn't able to. This was much later in his life, like in his 60s or 70s even. But there's a letter included of what he was planning to say to this therapist. And it starts with being abandoned by his mother. He's done a lot of the sort of Freudian analysis on himself already, and he lays it out in there. But it's still cloaked in that kind of self-delusion that I think we all, I don't know if indulge in is the right word, because it's usually unwittingly, but that we all do to some extent if you embark on therapy. You have to get through your self-lies first, and it's kind of a shame that apparently he never got to. You know, if that session didn't happen, it seemed that he didn't end up seeing that therapist. I don't know if he then saw another one. There aren't letters about it, but, you know, clearly he was also working through things in his writing. Like, we can see it again and again. Certainly we see his relationship with his father worked out in his writing. You know, you see it, like I said, an Honorable Schoolboy, but later on, obviously in A Perfect Spy, most famously, but also in Single and Single, in again and again, that kind of Ronnie figure comes up. And I wouldn't say he ever worked it out, because I think he was still working through that in his writing until the very end. But I'm sure it helped him to some degree. You know, he wrote an essay that ended up as part of The Pigeon Tunnel about that and how writing A Perfect Spy helped him. We do get a very interesting letter. Again, I'm sorry, I'm sort of jumping ahead here, but we get an interesting letter later on from his aunts writing together, or a letter to them, because they've written to him, upset about the way that he has portrayed Ronnie in the media around the release of A Perfect Spy. And he really defends his take and talks about how cathartic it was writing that, and how he needed to, and he hoped that it would be cathartic for others who also were victims. I don't remember if he used that word, but victims of Ronnie, and how he had consulted basically everyone else except them, including his own estranged mother and his stepmother. So yeah, he was always working on that. But what will be kind of new to me, I mean, the father stuff has been very evident because he was very open about it. But less so, he was very closed about his affairs. And, you know, some of that is coming out now. We only really get this one or two Susan Kenaway letters, and then later on some letters to a woman in California. A lot of stuff has come out in the press, particularly with the Seleka Dawson memoir that came out, sort of this tell-all that's been marketed as rather salacious. I haven't read it, so I'm not sure. I think you have.
I haven't yet, no.
Okay. But seems to have some interesting things as well. If Seisman gets around to doing that unexpurgated edition of his biography where he can talk about the affairs, I think that'll be very interesting, because he published a piece in a newspaper when the Dawson book came out, identifying seven, or talking about seven mistresses that he had identified and how some of them were the basis of various characters in the books. And I think that will be really interesting, because obviously one of the big areas that Le Carré has always taken a lot of flack from critics for is his writing of female characters. And, you know, you can excuse some of it away, as he himself does, to the lack of a mother figure. Well, can you, though? Because he does have a mother figure. You know, it becomes clear from this that his stepmother is a mother figure, but he still has used the excuse of being abandoned by his own mother, which I'm sure is, you know, yeah, how would you ever get over that? So that definitely plays a part in his role of writing women. But it'll be interesting to know how these other women in his life who were lovers affected that writing as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, the interesting thing that kind of comes out of this, reading this book of letters, is that he did, as you said, you know, his mother left him. Obviously, that was tremendously damaging. Yet he did have this stepmother that did step into the breach there to a certain extent. And it seems like rather that there was a lot of, for him, self-sabotage. And it's obvious that he knew what he was doing was not healthy. And yet he never found a way to really figure it out, it doesn't feel like, you know, because he kept doing this. He kept having these affairs, you know, you see throughout. And so you get the sense that he doesn't come to figure out what's causing him to do that, or a way, why that is the way that he is. Or maybe he just, he did come to some sort of understanding about that and just knew that that was just how it was going to be. I don't know. That's the interesting kind of question that I don't know that anybody will ever really answer.
And he had an interesting letter to his brother later in his life. I mean, a lot of the most interesting letters from a personal perspective were to his brother, Tony. But there was one later on where he talks about how wonderful Jane has been over his second wife, Jane has been over the years. And he says, despite my ways, you know, so he'll allude to his philandering without, I mean, he has a shorthand for it, just like, you know, so many other things. And clearly has had discussions with Tony about it to say my ways, you know. But it seems in that letter like he's sort of accepted that that's just how he is. I don't know if accepted is the right word. It might be more is using the excuse that that's just the way that he is. There is a letter to Jane fairly late on that really is I think the nicest of the love letters in the book, that really just kind of says, you are the one, like, of all of my searching, you were, I'm paraphrasing, unfortunately, not reading it, but it really does tell her that she was essentially the one woman for him. And I wonder, it felt genuine to me. I mean, who knows? But it didn't feel like the letter to Susan Kenaway, which didn't feel genuine, which felt disingenuous in a lot of ways. That one, to me, to Jane, felt like something very heartfelt.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote down in my notes, it was like almost like a letter of appreciation. It wasn't a love letter in the way that we think of love letters, as these kind of gushing, kind of trying to prove something to somebody necessarily, you know, like prove your love. It felt like he was just like kind of laying out his case for why their relationship was important to him in a way that was different, as you said, from a lot of those other the couple other glances that we got at those types of letters. The one thing I loved is that these letters to his mother that were really interesting that happened later in his life. You know, the other part is I love that he was faxing these letters because, you know, as we know, he loved his fax machine, but he was sending those to his birth mother after she walked out on him many, many years later when they reconnected.
Yeah, they didn't start corresponding until he was in his 20s, right?
Yeah, at the earliest, yes. And so I thought that was also interesting that, you know, he did try and connect in that way, which was surprising.
Although it's clear from letters that he writes to other people talking about that too, that he never feels the connection with her that he feels that he should feel. But he certainly, it seems like he really tried with her, you know, and he certainly stayed in touch with her, and it seems took care of her into her late life, because part of those faxes were sent to a nursing home that she was in later.
No, yeah, I just thought that was really interesting. The other letter that I thought was really just kind of wild, he writes to Stanley Mitchell, who was a friend at Oxford, but then later on, Mitchell finds out that actually he'd been spying on him, right? Because he was on the left wing there. And so there's just this, like, really kind of fraught relationship between the two of them when that information's out there. Although I there's this one line that he writes, you know, he talks about the relationship between some characters and a perfect spy. And then he has this line about the principle that Judas was a shit, not so much because he betrayed Christ, but because he loved him. And I thought that was an interesting kind of commentary.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a philanderer who has disseminated a lot throughout his career. I mean, it definitely, I think that ties in with his romantic relationships as well. Sort of making excuses there, but it's not like he didn't see that as well. I mean, that's what the majority of his books are about, the comparing the relationships of spies with the people they're betraying with their romantic relationships. He was very much aware of that connection, but it didn't stop him from using it as an excuse in his own relationships. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And I can see where he's coming from, for sure. I don't know who is the wronged party in that. Actually, I tended to side more with Le Carre in those letters. I don't know. Did you take a side in who's the wronged party? The one who was spied on by his friend, or the one who spied and still expected the friendship to go on?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was, everybody was so young. It's kind of hard to, like, at a certain point, it seemed like he regretted what he did. And so at that point, you're kind of like, okay, how old were they at that point? You got to let it go, dude. Come on. Come on, bro. Let it go. Move on.
I mean, it's clear from the Seisman biography that so many relationships he had over the years ended in bitterness. He would just cut people out of his life when they had strong disagreements. There's not as much of that in the letters as I was expecting, to be honest, although that's one example. Well, actually, it's not. I mean, that's almost a counterexample, because he really, I would have expected him to cut out Stanley Mitchell as soon as he started expressing his lack of forgiveness for what Le Carre had done and spying on him. But he doesn't. I mean, the letters continue. He does eventually in his last letter say, this will be the last letter because there's nothing more for me to say on the subject. But I was surprised that it went on as long as it did, like that he didn't just cut him off when he criticized him to begin with, based on how some of his other relationships ended. Friendship.
Yeah.
I mean, relationships in a friendship standpoint, not romantic.
Sure. Well, what other personal things did you want to touch on that popped out?
Well, for me, one of
the
main things I was looking for, the UK edition has on its cover him with one of his whippets in a chair. And so many of his author pictures on the books had him posed with his various whippets over the years. And I also grew up always with whippets in our household and really love that breed of dog. And I was interested in his relationships with his dogs.
letters to his whippets.
I wish there
really
were some. There were no letters to the whippets. There were mentions of dogs, and I don't know that all of his dogs were whippets over the years. I suspect he had some other breeds at times too, but certainly he seemed to have a lot of whippets. And while we didn't get those, we got some mentions of them, which I found always interesting, particularly that his dogs... Now, when I was growing up, our whippets would do lore coursing and chase like a white garbage bag around a track because they're sight hounds, so they chase based on sight. But his whippets, being hardcore English country dogs, were genuine rabbiters. And he had a letter that I really liked where he talks about how he's brought all the whippets down in his Mercedes SUV down from London to Cornwall, and he's trying to get some writing done in the morning, but the dogs aren't having it because they feel that when you're in the country, you should be rabbiting, or else what's the point of being in the country?
Yes.
So I liked that, the idea of his dogs being the masters of his life when he was down in the country. And I like, there was some discussion later on of, he said that he had wanted a dog and Jane had wanted a bitch, and they had gotten a transvestite. Was how, and this might not be the appropriate language of the time now, but in the early 2000s or whenever this letter was, so we got Poppy, and Poppy's a transvestite who will be a dog for me and a bitch for Jane. And I'm not quite sure what that is, if it was a neutered male or what, but I do think it's funny that that's kind of the way he was looking at, you know, getting a new dog and what they're, and that's the only dog whose name we get, I think, in the course of the book, which was a little sad to me, because I'm sure there were probably more letters, considering how much of a dog owner he was. Yeah, I think he always had dogs. There was probably more, and maybe Tim Cornwell didn't feel that was necessarily of interest to people outside the family. But I would have liked a little some more letters on the dogs, but I appreciated the ones that we did get.
Well, volume two will be all dogs. The dogs, or maybe you could release a limited edition, the dogs of John.
Yeah, I mean, one other personal thing you covered really talking to Steve, but worth dwelling on again, is his relationship with his kids. I mean, that letter that he sends to them when he's sort of preparing for his funeral 20 years before he actually died, and reflecting on the life that he's had and how he wants to be remembered. That I mean, I could see why Steve picked that as one of his five. It's just a great letter, sort of to the whole family, where he says, "You're all my favorite son." You know, that's part of it. It really is just not only looking at one's own legacy and facing one's mortality. It's interesting from that standpoint, but it's also interesting in his relationship with his family. And it really reminded me of in Silverview, how we get this kind of idealized family of, now I'm forgetting the name of the spy in that book, but the main British agent who's reviewing the possible Proctor.
Proctor, right. I think.
Yeah, which we discussed, you know, when we discussed that book, we speculated that home life was based on Le Carre's, and this letter really sort of seals my belief of that. It just really does sound like, you know, whatever issues he had in with his own dad, he seems to have figured it out. It seems that even if there were perhaps rocky periods, he seems to have had a really great relationship with his own kids and grandkids. Like, there is a letter too to a granddaughter later on that I also found just felt very close and personal. And I just, I'm glad, you know, in his introduction, Tim Cornwell talks about how he was going to include some of that. He's like, I've included probably more family things than another biographer, you know, might have done, but I don't want to dwell on that stuff too much. But I appreciated that he did, and I enjoyed getting that insight into his family life. And I mean, he's so many of his offspring, of his both his children and his grandchildren, are creative. Like, there's a number of other writers there. There's filmmakers. I mean, it seems like that was encouraged. I like getting those letters to his sons, or about his sons. You know, there's a lot of them that are bragging to people, you know, about how Nick has just published a novel and it's getting very good reviews, you know, and stuff like that. You know, they just made me feel a little closer to him as a person, and not just as an author who I admire, if that makes any sense.
But yeah, I mean, what I would say is, I think this book, more than the biography, brought David Cornwell to life as a human being. He obviously was a person, but when you read somebody's novels, you know, no matter what the author is, it's hard to get a sense of that sometimes. You know, you do, especially when they've been around for so long and been so influential, you do see them kind of put up on a pedestal, and it's hard to see them as a living, breathing person. And I think this book, more than the biography that we got from Sisman or Pigeon Tunnel, did that. All credit to Tim Cornwell for that, because I feel like he pulled the right set of letters out there to show that this is a person who had their issues. You know, they were not a perfect person. They were a complicated person who didn't always make the right choices. You can see some of his vanity. You can see his hubris. You can see his compassion and empathy. You got all of that in these letters, and that was what I appreciated the most. All right. Well, we're going to stop here, and we will return for part two of this three-part series, looking at his professional life in the next episode. I'll have links to various things discussed today in the show notes and on the episode page at lecarrecast.com. If you enjoyed the show, you'd be doing myself a huge favor by subscribing and reviewing it on Apple Podcasts. It'll help all those other Le Carre fans find the show. Drop us a comment on the website or on Twitter at lecarrecast. You can follow me as I talk about non-Le Carre stuff at spywrite.com or at spywrite on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses, created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.